Today I spoke with my friend Darnell Samuels. Darnell is the co-host of the Sixth Sense Report. Sixth Sense Report is a fantastic podcast. You should all check it out. It's where Joel and him discuss ideas and issues that affect Canadians in an intellectually honest way. In this episode, Darnell and I talk about what it's like being black and conservative, how he became a conservative. We talk about minimum wage. We talk about Walter Williams. We talk about his black love ethic. We talk about family, the importance of family, and why Darnell does not like the way Candace Owens engages with people. He thinks that there's a better way to convince people of conservatism instead of being brash. So I hope you enjoy this podcast as much as I did. Check it out. What's up, Darnell?
How you doing, IJ?
Doing well, man. We got a early morning for us. You came down here quite early.
Yeah, but it was worth it, man. I'm excited. I'm really excited. So, man, this is my first interview, man. You're the first person to ask my opinion on something.
Here's the thing. I'll start off with a very light topic. What's it like being black and being social conservative?
Oh, okay. Man, it's weird, man, because like, you know, I was raised liberal, but you didn't know it was liberal. So it's just, there's just like this common narrative among, you know, being black. Like for example, you get the talk from your parents. So I got the talk. And for those who don't know what the talk is, it's the talk your parents give you. Give their black kids, usually their sons, that you are, as a black male, or you know, the system, the world is against you, so you have to work two times as hard as your white counterparts to get anywhere in life. And so I was raised, even by my dad, you know, that the police authority is my enemy. And you know, the music, the rap music I listen to, you know, it's against authority. So it was just a common narrative that I grew up with. And then when I started being introduced to conservative ideas, it was just like a paradigm shift. It was just weird.
So is this talk like most black kids get this talk? Is this common?
Yes. I would say it's common in the sense, as common as the narrative as like just liberal thought. Now, of course, you know, at the time, you know, I don't know what's liberal. I don't know what's conservative. Right. All I know is that, you know, police hurt black people. Black people seem to get the short end of the stick. And that's it. And that's a fact. You don't, like, when people say, oh, that's liberal. What? I don't know what liberal is. I don't know what conservative is. All I know is that this is my reality. And that's it. So... Now, of course, not every single black parent does this, but it's done out of safety.
Okay.
So it's not done out of hatred. It's done out of safety and love, because once your child steps out into the real world, yeah, racism hurts. Yeah. You know what I mean? And being roughed up, by the authority figures hurts. Having getting the short end of the stick hurts. So they're kind of like preparing you for real life. Yeah, so that's done out of love in that sense.
So when you, after the talk, when you were out in the real world, was it did you notice that what they were saying were true? Or was it confirmation bias, sort of? You're like, oh yeah, this is happening for sure.
Confirmation bias. That's a good way to put it. Good way to put it, but I would say no, it's not confirmation bias. So for example, you know, my dad told me about the police when I was a kid, and like my very first interaction with the police was 10 years old.
Really?
I'm on a bike and they're pulling me over.
What?
Yeah, oh yeah.
For what?
You know what? It was just, yo, man, it was just the interactions. It was just a constant interaction.
Was it like a, hey, what's up, kid? Or like, what are you doing here?
No, it's more like, yeah, what are you doing here? Or, you know, do you got a record? What's your name?
What?
Yeah, I know.
As a 10-year-old,
right?
Like,
yeah, yo. Right? So, you know, and I told my dad, and my dad's like, okay, next time a police asks you a question, you tell him to go F himself. Right? Like, you know, that's my pop. So he was like, yeah, tell him to go F himself. And so from then on, from that day on, I've constantly been in confrontation with police. You know, even like, you know, sometimes they'll come to my house asking for my friends, right? So my mom would be like, hey, man, tell them you don't know anything. You know what I mean? Because you know what I mean? Like, the next thing you know, people find out the police came to my house, and then they go and book my boy Kevin.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, well, they were, the last place they were at was Darnell's house. Darnell's snitching on the block, you know? And then everybody's coming at me. Even like, you know, when I was at Tyndale, I'm being stopped by police.
What?
Brother.
What do you mean?
This guy, this guy's like a Tyndale. What? Yeah. Well,
what, the security guards, or you mean
no,
just like the cops?
No, bro.
On,
okay,
on,
so
cops and baby.
So, back at the old building, we had the Shoppers Drug Mart in the back.
That's right.
And so, you know, I went in to go grab, I don't know, lotion or whatever. And I went in, and I came out. I didn't buy anything. I was like, oh, man, the Shoppers Drug Mart's too expensive, anyways.
Yeah.
And I came out, and there's a police officer. There's a car in front of the store, and the police officer was sitting on the car. And when I walked out, I saw him.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, frig. And I just stopped. And I just put my hands up. And then he just looked at me and said, sorry, they called me. He's like, sorry, they called me. And I, yeah, but again, I, you know, I've been through this. That's what I'm saying. Like, from when I was young.
So why would they call you? What,
because somebody in the store, the manager, thought I was suspicious. So he called the police.
Suspiciously?
Pardon?
Were you dressed?
No, like no. No, but I was in the store. Like, I couldn't figure out what I wanted to buy, so I guess that looks suspicious.
Oh, because you're like,
just, you know, wander. Yeah, you know, man, your Shoppers Drug Mart has a lot. I was probably reading the magazines or whatever. I don't know. Thinking to buy liquor.
There's a black man, 911. There's a black man. He's just picked up lotion.
Yeah, I'm not sure what he wants to get, but I remember I came out and I didn't have anything in my hand. So either way, he was already there waiting. So I already saw him there waiting, and I knew he was there for me. And I just stopped, and then he just said, sorry, man. They called me, and I just put my hands up. I said, yo, don't worry, man. I already know. It's okay.
Was this a Caucasian cop?
No, a brown guy.
The brown guy.
Yeah. So it was just one of those things. I said, you know, I told the officer, I was like, look, man, it's cool. Like, it's okay. I'm used to it, so it doesn't bother me anymore. Yeah. So I just put my, and he just started patting me down in front of the store, started searching me.
Yo, that's nuts.
Yeah, it didn't bother me, though.
Because you're like, whatever.
Yeah, it really
nothing to hide.
Bro, it doesn't bother me, man. It really doesn't. It's just part of life, and it didn't bother me. Now, when I told people, they were shocked. But the other black guy at Tyndale, Andre.
Andre, yeah.
Yeah, Andre Paris. So I told Andre. And Andre's like, yeah. And his girlfriend at the time, she was like, they did what? I can't believe this. This is outrageous. I can't. And me and Andre are looking at each other like, what do you mean this is outrageous? This is life, this is normal. Man. This is normal, man. That's so we kind of laughed about it, but she was like offended. But, you know, me and Andre weren't offended. We're like, yo, man, like, this is just.
But is it normal to not be offended, or is it more normal to be offended?
Because my mom and dad already primed me for this.
Yeah.
I was already used to it.
Oh.
There's been times I've been surrounded on a block. Back when I had to go see, I think, a psychologist or a therapist, because I was having issues. And so he lived in a rich neighborhood. And so my dad was, you know, just paying for my session. Mm-hmm. And then I went outside to go wait by the car. And I was just sitting on the car, waiting by the car.
Yeah.
And I was like this. So then the police car comes down one end of the road, and then he cuts me off. And then on the other end of the road, a police officer comes, and they cut me off. And they're like, so they cut me off, and I'm on the car, and they cut me off, and they're asking me, what am I doing in the neighborhood?
Yeah.
And I said, oh, I'm here to see my doctor. They're like, your doctor? Where does he live? I'm like, oh, he's over there. And, you know, they checked and they followed up. They said, yeah, well, somebody in the neighborhood saw you out here and it looked like you didn't belong. So they called the police. And I was like, okay, that's cool. They're like, oh, yeah, okay, well, sorry about that. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, but, yo, my dad came out. Oh, man. So, you know, it was just one of those things. Like, my dad came out, and he just, you know, he just looked hurt. And, you know, he was quiet on the way home. We were just quiet, didn't say much. But it was just, you know, again, it didn't bother me. Although it did kind of bother me because they surrounded me. And so, you know what I mean?
As if you're like a criminal.
Well, huh?
As if you were a criminal.
Hey, man, like this is why, you know. So it was like I was on the car, but okay, I was nervous a little bit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because if I'm surrounded, that means they probably think I'm a threat and, you know, they might shoot on sight.
Right.
So, you know, I, like I said, I got the talk. So I already know not to act crazy.
Yeah.
You know, so I just waited for them to approach me and so forth. So. Yeah, so I wouldn't say that's confirmation bias. Like,
yeah.
One more story for the audience. So I know that's just all. Yeah, like when I'm telling, like, so that's when I say to people, like, they're like, "Oh man, you're conservative, man. Yo, this guy's
crazy."
Yeah, well, but I've experienced these things, but I still have a conservative way of looking at it.
Yeah, because okay, tell what's the story.
So, my job had, at the time. They had a zero tolerance policy on being late. So I'm like, okay, Frank. So I'm in the mall.
Yeah.
At Square One. And I'm like, you know, I'm running through the mall, man. I'm trying to get to, you know, catch the bus so I don't, you know, so I don't get in trouble. I'm doing all right. And I'm wearing my Blue Jays fitted. And not this one, but the one with the, not the old logo, but the new one at the time. And yeah, man. I ran and then I was running to the door and then there's a security guard. It was a police officer. It was a police officer standing in front of the door. And as I'm moving towards the door, he's like cutting me off and he says, "Come with me." And I was like, man. So they detained me.
In the mall.
Huh?
In the mall.
No, because they have like a police station attached to the mall.
Okay.
So then they put me in a holding cell sorta, until they can clarify who I was, because the night before there was a shooting in the subway and someone was killed. So I fit the description of the guy who did the shooting.
Right.
So the guy who did the shooting had a Blue Jays fitted on.
Okay.
But you know, but for anybody that knows, you know, just in general, whatever city you're from, you wear the baseball cap of the city you're from. You know what I mean? If you're from New York, you know, you wear your Yankees.
Yeah.
You know, if you're from Toronto, you wear your Blue Jays, right? Everybody has a Blue Jays hat.
Yeah.
You know, so it was just one of those things. But so that's why, you know, they detained me. They searched my stuff. They put me in a holding cell just to make sure who I was. And all I said, man, I wasn't even mad. I was just like, look, man, you need to write me a letter and tell Mark Francis that that you guys were holding me up, man, because he's not going to believe me. You know what I mean? So it was kind of funny. I was just like, yo, just make sure you guys write this out and just let them know, like, you know, I'm late because you guys had to search me, you know? So it was cool at that point. But again, like, I'm only giving you these stories because this adds to the narrative of, for some black people. Mm-hmm. So that's why your parents would give you that talk. So
it's for your safety. They're not saying. So it's not necessarily that it's a. They're not trying to make you hate the cops. They're just trying to say, "Hey, this is a reality. Just be. I want you to be aware of it so that you don't get shot."
Or you know, like act brand new, or like you know, the police say, "Hey, come with me." What? I have rights out here. Don't you ever get your hands. Get your. Next thing you know what I mean, I'm Trayvon Martin or something. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's crazy. So you really can't. Or Michael Brown. It's just one of those things like, yo, you can't act crazy. As a black person, like, you know, you really have to chill.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, again, but that was just part of the narrative, the music I listen to, the movies I watch, the TVs I, you know, watch, Fresh Prince. Fresh Prince was,
Fresh Prince was
detained.
Awesome.
Yeah, but he was detained by the police, him and Carlton. They were pulled over. There was an episode.
Okay.
Where they were pulled over. And, you know, then Philip, you know, Uncle Phil had to come and get them out because he was a judge. Yeah. And the white officers didn't believe him. But, you know, Uncle Phil, like, was just, you know, gave him that lawyer judge talk. And then eventually, you know, Uncle Phil called one of his friends, one of his white friends, and they got Will and Carlton out of jail. And at the end, Carlton and Will, you know, Carlton was still second guessing the police pulling them over. Like Carlton didn't get it. Right. Like Will, you know, Will's from West Philadelphia. He gets it, you know. And so Carlton's like, but I would have pulled myself over. He's like, but I would, he's like, you could see him wrestling with it.
Yeah.
He's like, but Will, like, they pulled us over because they thought we were criminals, not because we were black.
Yeah.
You know, and Will's just like, look, Carlton, they only see one thing. And he just taps him on his face. He's like, yeah. They only see one thing. Hmm. And then he leaves the room, and then Carlton's still standing there. And he's like, but I would have pulled myself over. And he was, like, still confused. Hmm. So these are, you know, these are narratives you see, like, on your favorite TV shows in the music. And it's just part of the narrative. So I would, like, as I said, for most black people or for some who aren't as well versed in political rhetoric, mm-hmm. yeah, they're not going to say, "Oh, I'm leftist or I'm a liberal or I'm this." All they say is, "Look, man, all I know is I can be pulled over, so I better not act crazy where I can get myself killed."
Right, and you can even like you could be like, "Oh, I have been pulled over, and so this is most likely okay." So here's the thing: you've been pulled over, you've been surrounded mm-hmm. by cops, mm-hmm. and this fits what we would call the liberal narrative of things.
Yeah.
But you're not a liberal by any stretch of the means, if I'm correct.
Well, I used to.
What happened? Like how? Okay, I'm trying to understand how it is that with all this happening, mm-hmm. how you're not a liberal.
Well, I think like there's two sides to it. I guess so. Like, I guess for me being a Christian, and understanding sin of people and then understanding like extending a measure of grace, mm-hmm. like always assume the best, always assume the best until you could prove otherwise, because you don't know the intentions. I can't read the intentions of a man's heart, and a man's mind. Just like those police who came to search me in front of Shoppers Drug Mart, like he's only just doing his job. Mm-hmm. So that's why I said to him, like, yo, it's okay. Like you're doing your job.
Yeah.
Like I get it. And I, you know, you can't tell what's on a person's heart or mind. So it's that's sin to falsely accuse somebody of something like that. So that's right. Why I don't play with that. But I think politically or socially, I changed stumbling upon like Thomas Sowell material, taking economics with Professor Krauss.
Yeah.
And yeah, so basically with Sowell, it was more so hearing another side of the black experience that rarely is ever heard. I know. I never. I wasn't introduced to any of these ideas. You know what I mean? So it's usually like Jesse Jackson, L. Sharpton.
Yes.
On one side. Mm-hmm. Thomas Sowell, Walter Williams on the other. I've never heard of Thomas Sowell. I've never heard of Walter Williams. You know Jesse Jackson and those guys. You know what I mean? So you're used to the rhetoric. So... yeah, so I stumbled across his material in class.
So did you read Basic Economics or
Basic Economics and
Vision of the Anointed?
No, not Vision of the Anointed. Oh gosh, I have to look that up. Let me see. Vision of the Anointed. But you know what? A lot of times it was just it was just his lectures. So I was looking at his his talks, his lectures.
Yeah.
Reading essays. You know, really getting, instead of, you know, I wasn't really getting to the books just yet. I was just let me get a short snippet guy? Of, yeah, who is this guy talking like a coon?
Right.
Right. Oh, do you know what a coon is?
That's a black guy who is a white guy. Inside.
Yeah, well, it's a derogatory term towards black people. So, or a black person. So black people use it among each other. So it's
like a traitor or something?
Yeah, like a traitor, a coon, Uncle Tom. Uncle Tom.
Okay, I've heard Uncle Tom.
Yeah. So I was just like, man, this guy talking like a coon. You know what I mean? So you're dismissing, but it was just for me at this point. For me, I was on this whole bent about solutions, so I didn't really dismiss his ideas outright. I didn't dismiss his ideas outright. I was just more so thinking like, okay, I wanna fulfill the first Great Commission, which is the cultural mandate found in Genesis chapter 1, verses 28 to 26, where God gives a command to all people to cultivate creation for the benefit of others. So I'm on this. So this whole principle, I'm sold on, and I'm all about solutions. So I didn't dismiss his ideas. I was just like, okay, well, he's offering solutions that sound like they work, you know? So, yeah.
So what was the one thing that you read from Saul that made you really go, okay, maybe there's something more to this?
The Quest for Cosmic Justice.
Quest for Cosmic Justice. Okay.
Yeah, so I have Quest for Cosmic Justice, and then I have at home, I can't remember what it was. Because I had the Basic Economics, and then Quest for Justice. Economic Facts and Fallacies.
Yes.
So I have Economic Facts and Fallacies, and then the Quest for Cosmic Justice. And then checking out his blog post, but I think it wasn't necessarily him, but it was Walter Williams.
Okay.
That made me say, oh shoot, this is interesting. So his whole thing, I didn't read any books from him, but there was like something on YouTube where he was explaining minimum wage.
Yeah.
And he was basically, you know, showing how minimum wage hurts black people.
Right.
And I was just like, oh, what? So basically minimum wage, it phases two types of people out of the market. Young people, mm-hmm. and low-skilled workers.
Right.
It phases out low-skilled, and that turns out to be young black people. Low-skilled workers and young people. Yeah, statistically. Okay. It phases out. And it's not just black people who may be young and unskilled, but usually it falls on that end of the spectrum. And even like the origin of minimum wage was to keep black people out of...
Was it really?
During apartheid. So
really?
Yeah. So with apartheid, you have, before it, you have, you know, blacks able to work in the market. So if the minimum wage is zero, as most Chicago school economists would say, like the true minimum wage is zero.
Yeah.
And so you start there and you're like, okay, well, zero. Well, why zero? Well, at this point, now you can barter for work. So if white workers are willing to work for $10, but then a black worker comes and says, okay, well, I'll work for $9.
Yeah.
Well, the employer's like, well, shoot, I'm going to save some money.
Yeah.
If
they can do the same work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going for the.
Right. Yeah. And so now for the white worker, you're like, okay, am I going to go below that $9?
Yeah.
Well, you know what I mean? Like at a certain point, you're like, okay, no, that's just too low for me. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, you're hiring the black person. And even like, you know, just even like fresh out of slavery, you know, blacks were good workers. We developed skills during slavery that made us employable.
Yeah.
So you have blacks being able to find work because the minimum wage is zero. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times people say, oh, well, you know, black people aren't able to find work because of racism. Well, no, we were able to find work even though there was racism because the minimum wage was zero.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, unions started saying, okay, well, you know, whites started to form unions and they said, okay, well, look, we'll cut it off minimum wage at this point. That way it phases out all the black people and they can't barter
Right.
Yeah. They can't barter to.
Because once you have a minimum wage, you can't be like, look, I'll work for $8 at minimum wage, is $10.
Yeah. Because it's illegal. Yeah. It's illegal. Yeah. It's illegal to pay somebody below that amount. But if somebody's willing to grind and put in the work.
Yeah.
You know, because people don't really see it that way. They just say, okay, well, it's not enough money.
Yeah.
But the higher you raise it, then even like for employers, you know, now like you're hiring less people.
You are.
You know what I mean? So when I heard that, I was just like, wait a minute, that makes sense. You know, it's just math. And that's the thing. You know, like not to go off on a tangent, but this is why you know, people study classical education.
Mm.
In that, you know, math is one of those components, arithmetic, and that arithmetic helps you come to the truth because, you know, truth is all about the math. 1 + 1 = 2.
Hmm.
So, you know, the numbers are verifiable.
Yeah.
When you do the math, and that's why I was able to, when Walter Williams was doing the math on minimum wage, I was like, well, the math looks like it all adds up. And it ends up hurting black people. But it's funny. But then black people who hold to a liberal view,
mm-hmm.
what do they vote? that they're voting for minimum you know the minimum wage to go up.
Yeah.
Right? They're putting it to go up. They're like, yeah, black people need more, you know, young black moms need more money.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, you're like, ah, you know, our young men are out of work.
Yeah.
We gotta, you know, we gotta raise it so they can do stuff with them. Well, yeah, but now you're putting more of them out of work.
Hmm.
So this is now this is what sparks me where I'm like, okay, you know what? This economics thing, to me, if I can give a definition, like to me, economics is the science of helping people. That's how I would summarize it. You know, because now, like, if you're really trying to help people, if you're really serious,
yeah.
then you'll do the math and you'll study the science on what works and what doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because not doing it properly, you end up hurting those you're trying to help.
Right. Long-term-wise, you might end up hurting them.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. And that's why, you know, not a shameless plug, but, you know, that's why we started Sixth Sense Report.
Yeah. So. See, there's the thing that you... About minimum wage, when what was it? Usually, when you hear it in the news, it's about affordability, right? It's like, man, we need to raise minimum wage because we can't afford to live in, let's say, Toronto. I mean, Toronto is an expensive city. Let's be clear, but it's always we can't afford to live on what's the minimum wage here? 12?
15 now. 15.
What?
Yeah, man, it's 15. Yeah, it's 15, bro.
It's 15?
Yeah, it's 15 here. We're doing all right. Yeah, we're doing all right.
I'm over here thinking it's like 1275.
Yeah, no, we're 15, man. We're 15.
Was this from Kathleen Wynn?
Yeah, we're 15. I know, right? I know. It's crazy.
How is someone, unless, do we have, is the minimum wage here 15 for if you're 21 and above? Like, is there a minimum wage for that? Underage kids working?
I can't remember, but I think I can remember. Once we get to a certain point in the year, it's for just across the board.
Good.
Yeah, it's just 15 bucks across the board. So I mean,
that's crazy. If you don't have any experience, who's going to pay you 15 bucks you to gain experience?
Right. And then also, you know, you think about it, like when I can't remember what it was before, I think it was probably like 12 or something. But if you think about it, for like a person who was already making 15,
yeah,
and this wasn't the minimum, and the minimum was like 12 or 11, and then you bring it up to 15, that neutralizes, like eventually everything adjusts, you know, like the prices adjust,
yep.
And the person who was already at 15, it brings them down because now their $15 doesn't go as far as it used to.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So you're like, wait a minute, now I'm making a minimum wage.
Yeah.
When I was make, you know, 15 was pretty good because those guys were making less. But now you're like, oh, wait a minute. Wait, this neutralizes me. So, you know, it hurts people in different ways when you really start to look at it. But yeah. So Walter Williams was Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell really got me going. And also Larry Elder. I'm not sure if you remember
Larry. Yes, Larry Elder.
Oh, man. So Larry Elder, it's funny. It's funny you say this. Okay, so Larry Elder, and, you know, he's a jerk, man. He's a jerk, bro.
In his interview, he's always, like, straight-faced.
He's a jerk and a half, man. So as far as, like, me being conservative, you know, Larry Elder's a conservative. But he speaks... What was attractive to me about him was that he was aggressive.
Hmm.
Oh yeah, like
you didn't take a backseat in conversation.
Well, he was just aggressive in his rhetoric. Not, well, of course, you know, being a jerk, but also calling out certain truths. In that, like, he was always he just simply asked for proof.
Right. And what's your evidence?
Yeah. So what's your evidence? Yeah, he's like, what's your evidence? What's your proof? What's your proof? And you're like, well, I was stopped. I was surrounded. Yeah. It happened to me. He's like, okay, yeah, that happened to you. But like, what's the proof? So he was very aggressive in that way where it kind of forced me to like, okay, like really reevaluate, you know, am I interpreting things by my experience or, right. you know, even just looking at the numbers? So these are things that, you know, he was one of those guys that kind of opened up my eyes, but I feel like being conservative, a black conservative, I think there's still a way, I feel like Larry Elder could do a better job of communicating his ideas.
Hmm.
rather than, you know, going straight for like shock value. Him and what's that other black girl's name?
Candace Owens.
Yeah, Candace Owens. I feel like
you think they're doing the same thing that the liberals are doing?
No, I just feel like I feel like, you know, the shock value, you know, like, you know, coming in and guns blazing. That hasn't really been my way necessarily of coming across, especially as Christians. Like, you know, like I think it's probably the Christian in me, because we know as Christians that the gospel's already an offense. Mm. It's already offensive.
Right.
There's no need to come in with guns blazing. So, you know, when you're really trying to, you know, witness to somebody, you know, you're coming across gentle, you're trying to find points of agreeance,
right,
to slide in with the gospel. Because, you know, people are like, oh, I don't like Christians. I don't want to hear what you guys have to say because this and that, and you're dismissed. And they miss an opportunity for eternal life. So I kind of take that principle, and there are truths within the conservative camp that would be helpful to black people. So I try not to be offensive. I try not to be too harsh, okay, because I was there too. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I was, you know, I was stopped. You know what I mean? I used to rap songs of F the Police. You know,
Of your lines?
Huh?
Can you give us one of your lines from your old
rap? It's been a while, man. But essentially, like, it was one of those things where I was just really trying to not offend people, but try to communicate my ideas in a more gentler way, and I feel like they could do that too. But, you know, like I said, like I've been there, and you resonate with the liberal narrative, because I've been there, and I have family members who are part of that. But yeah, I just felt like those guys could do a better job communicating those ideas, because then maybe you would have more blacks who jump think on. More conservative.
That's interesting, because I to me, my thinking, my thought process was, at least with Candace Owens and
Larry Elder,
is that the reason that they're presenting their views the way they are doing it is because they're reacting to how aggressive the liberals are. So they're like, well, we're going to do it the same way, and it's
I wouldn't say liberals are aggressive.
You wouldn't think they're aggressive?
No, I wouldn't say that they're aggressive. I would say that Candace and Larry Elder are annoyed. That's a different thing. I think they're just annoyed with, and I'm not saying black people, they're just annoyed with the stupidity. I'm not saying black people are stupid, but they're annoyed with the stupidity that they see among some blacks.
Okay.
So, you know, when you're annoyed, you're just like, look, man, I'm just tired of this crap.
I'm just
you guys
say
need to,
whatever. With no
man. You guys just need to wake up, man. You guys just need to stop, you know, having kids out of wedlock and stop, you know, saying F the police, but then turn around calling the police when someone steals your stuff. Like, you guys just need to, you know, cut all that out. Yeah. But yeah, so I think that's where they were kind of coming from.
So you think a better way to communicate would be a more of a, like a long form, calmer, more, because it's not like they're not irrational, right, when they're presenting these things, do you think?
Who's being irrational?
Sorry, Candace Owens and
Larry Elder. They're bringing pretty good arguments, even like, you know, like Larry Elder, just with the systemic racism.
What are your thoughts on systemic racism? Because just from your experience, right, you would think, hey, maybe there's a bias against black people.
So part of it is like, it's the same thing being a Christian. You know, when people say, okay, you know, is God real? How do you know, there's life after death? When you study apologetics, you know, which is the defending the faith, you learn that you got to define your terms. And you know, you're not trying to be a superhero in the conversation and answer every question, but just clarifying your terms. And I think, you know, dealing with systemic racism or institutional racism, defining the terms, that's where you start. You know what I mean? Like, okay, so for me, I guess I've been blessed to be a slow thinker. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it gets me trouble at work. and it gets me trouble at home with my wife.
Okay.
So my wife will say, go get this.
Yeah.
And then I'll get the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And she'll be like, no, what? Get this. And then I'll get the wrong thing. She'll say, okay, you know, she'll send me instructions to make lunch. And she's like, you get this pan. And I'm like, okay, I took a picture of the pan. I sent her a pan. She's like, no, not that pan. I said, okay, okay, okay. And I got two pans. I was like, okay, I got to get this right. I started with two pans. And she just laughed. And she's like, no. You know, like she's, and it was just one of those just ongoing things. She's like, yeah, Darnell. And she'll explain to other people, like, you know, when Darnell asks you questions, he's not doing that to be a jerk. He really just doesn't get it. He's just a slow thinker that way.
Okay.
So I can acknowledge that I'm a slow thinker and I don't get things. And that's why people kind of get annoyed with me. They're like, okay, but you don't get this? And I'm like, actually, no, I don't. Right. I don't get, like, ask my boss, ask my wife. Like, I don't get simple things. So when I'm saying, like, what's institutional racism, I'm not being...
You're not being facetious.
Yeah, no. Like, when I'm saying, okay, sorry, I don't know what that means. Okay. What do you mean? Mm. Like, yes, I've been pulled over, but, like, okay, you're using a term. When Christians, like, people are using terms, like, okay, what do you mean propitiation? What do you mean Christ rose from the dead?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you know, Jesus rose from the dead. You know, he got up and made barbecue and with the apostles.
Yeah, what's up?
Yeah, but you're like, wait, you know, slow down. What do you mean that? But you know, systemic racism, institutional racism, like, okay, well, okay, show me a policy. Let's start there.
Okay.
Show me something. And so for me...
Show you a policy where it's overtly racist.
Yeah. Well, explicit, implicit, you know, looking at, you know, verifying a text, and dealing with the problems so we can get to the solution. But a lot of times is the discussion goes in this direction. Do you believe in institutional racism? And then you say, well, no. Well, then you must be part of the problem. I'm like, whoa, how did we
that's a big jump.
how did we get there? Like, or oh, it's, come on, it's obvious.
Yeah.
It's obvious. Come on, just look around. Like, what, you haven't been stopped by the police before? You know, that's almost like a Christian, and sorry for the listeners, like, I'm just explaining to you like how my train of thought works. So yeah. I keep going back to Christianity.
That's fine.
So for me, like, my thoughts are always going back and forth, like, how's a Christian handle this? So if an unbeliever says to you, or a Christian says, oh, you know, God is real. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, I don't understand how God is real, or I don't believe God is real. How? What do you mean you can't know God is real? Just look around you. Look around you. You're breathing. Look, it's obvious. It's obvious. Well, no, it's, no. God's existence is not obvious. Mm-hmm. Christ rising from the dead is not obvious. Mm. Systemic racism is not obvious. You know, so like there's a measure of patience that you have to show and clarity. You got to speak with clarity. Like, okay, well, how are we going to prove God is real? Okay, we'll use the cosmological argument. We'll use the theological argument. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like Christians, that's how we talk. When we evangelize, we have to be like, okay, you know, the swoon theory in regards to Christ's resurrection and really being detailed. So that's why that's the framework I'm working from. So when we get into these social discussions, you know, I'm saying, okay, sorry, help me out here. Mm. How are you defining institution? Well, an institution, you know, I'm like, well, family is an institution.
Yeah.
The church is an institution. Mm. Government's an institution. Which one and which policy are you looking at and how it works? So I say all that to say that when people bring up ideas of institutional racism and systemic racism or oppression, I'm like, okay, let's talk. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to listen. So I'm not dismissive of it.
Yeah.
I'm not dismissive of it because that would be ungracious.
Yeah.
Right? That would be ungracious for me to just say, oh, it doesn't exist.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's not how I'm allowed to conduct myself as a Christian. I have to be like, okay, I'm assuming you are being honest and that you're telling me the truth and that this thing is really hurting you. Show me. Help me. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, no, it does. And I'm assuming that, like you said, when it comes to topics of race, it gets you into a lot of trouble.
Well, again, part of it is just because I'm always asking for clarity.
Yeah.
And then people get annoyed because they're just like, well, it's obvious. Like, what do you mean? Why do you keep asking? But I'm like, well, like I want to be clear. You know, the Bible passage that says, you know, by his stripes we were healed.
Yeah.
the whole time I thought he had a, Jesus had a striped jacket. I didn't know it was lashes.
Right.
Like, it took me a long time to figure out it was lashes. The whole time I'm thinking, oh, why his stripes were healed? I'm like, oh, Jesus had a striped jacket. Well, how do I think? You know what I mean? Right. I really believe Jesus had a striped jacket, and then the woman touched his jacket.
Yeah.
And it was probably a nice jacket, and she was healed. So I was always believing that.
Yeah.
So for me, like, as, like I said, like, certain connections, it's hard for me to make. So sometimes I have to let people know, like, look, man, like, I'm not as smart as I look. You know, or as I he's pretend to be, smarter. or I'm not as smart as I pretend to be on the podcast. You know what I mean? So it's just one of those things, just clarifying that. But generally, again, I try to look for solutions. So anybody, I'll give you guys a tip if you're getting in a conversation with me, how to navigate that. So I'm very big on solutions, like I said. So if we're going to talk about social justice and systemic racism or anything, I'm all about solutions, man. Like, you know, point out the problem and let's work together and get to the solutions.
Yeah.
The problem is we never get to talk about solutions. We only argue about the problem. And that's what's annoying, especially within the Christian circles where there's a lot of, you know, dispute. And I love arguments. I love disputes.
Yeah.
But it never gets past the point of what the problem is versus, like, let's talk about solutions. Because once you get to, once you start talking about solutions, then it gets to a point of, it now comes about, now the conversation is about economics. Because as Christians, you know, and for those of you guys who don't know, and I guess I'm just assuming, but just to be clear. So like within, you know, the Reformed circle of Christianity. Reformed, that's the doctrines of grace, like Calvinistic in their thinking, divine election, big God theology. Guys like James White, Tom Buck. I'll throw my boy Sam Say in there. Give him a shout out. Give my guy Sam Say a shout out. Yeah, so you have the John MacArthur and those guys who are saying no to social justice. Daryl Harrison is another good guy.
They're saying no social justice?
So they're saying no to social justice.
Are they saying social justice? Are they defining social justice as what?
Well, they're against their counterparts pushing the agenda of social justice. And social justice, so they'll use the term, because they hate using the term Marxist in nature.
Yeah.
But I only say Marxist in nature in regards to the ideology of classism.
Okay.
Right? So, we're talking about, so just to be clear, so the audience can follow along. So I'll categorize it as Team Woke, Team Spoke.
Team Woke and Team Spoke.
Right.
Okay.
Team Woke. Team Spoke. So MacArthur and those conservative guys, Daryl Harrison and those guys, I would call them Team Spoke. So they're very, what has God spoken?
Okay.
That's it. What has God spoken? And that's it. We don't go above the line. We don't go under the line of scripture. For Team Woke, it's like, Pastor Eric Mason, Anthony Bradley, Taylor Gray, Akemeni from Truth's Table.
Okay.
It's four black women, podcast for four black women. It's more social justice-y. And a bunch of others. So they're saying, let's help these people. Let's help fix the inequality we see in society. So that's where the dispute is between within the Reformed camp.
Okay.
And I would say the reason why it's within the Reformed camp is because I think Reformed people are argumentative in nature.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you wouldn't be Reformed. We wouldn't have the Reformation today if Martin Luther wasn't argumentative. If he wasn't confrontational. Mm. Right? Like we wouldn't be here as people are like, well, I'm not Reformed. Well, yeah, because of the Reformation, you're here now today. We're not Catholic.
Yeah.
Why you have freedom to be Pentecostal or non-denominational, even though it's no such thing as a non-denomination. Yeah.
Sure. They're all Baptist.
Yeah, right. You know what I mean? So it's because of reformers why, you know, Christians can freely practice whatever denomination they want today. But just in nature, because they're very heavy exegetically and drawing a line and holiness and God's sovereignty, do you have, it breeds a ground of argumentation, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. You know, we're okay with that. But the problem is that it never gets to the point of conversation.
Okay. That's, you know, that's the important thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it never gets to that point. It's always just talking about the, it's always more so like arguing about the offense of not believing. Like, you know, Team Woke is like, well, how could you not believe this? You guys are, being disobedient. Uh-huh. And Team Spoke is like, what? How could you believe that? Yeah. You guys are being disobedient. Mm. You know, as opposed to saying, okay, well,
here's the problem. There's a solution.
Man.
Let's try to work it out.
Yeah. And it's funny to me because it's just like, you know, James White, who, you know, is an apologist, and he's Team Spoke. He's a debater. Like that's what he does.
Yeah.
You know how some people are preachers, some people are theologians and they teach in a classroom, yeah, like Professor Carter. Like James White, his thing is like he travels the world and he debates people.
Right.
Muslims, Jehovah Witnesses, Mormons, it doesn't matter who it is.
Yeah.
James is going at them. But there hasn't been a debate scheduled within this little.
Interesting.
Yeah. Interesting. Isn't it? They, you know, you're like, you know, he'll, you know, a debate will happen with a Muslim.
Yeah.
A debate will happen with a Mormon, a Jehovah Witness, or Seventh-day Adventist.
But not with this.
Non-Christians. Like he'll debate, you know, there's debates with non-Christians. But you're like, wait a minute. So how come you haven't even debated guys within the camp, you know, within the Reform camp over these issues? So that's when you know something is wrong. Mm. Now, you know, James White is very intimidating.
It's because he's a bald head.
as bald head, as goatee, no, but his bow tie is very intimidating. No, but James White he champions the spirit of Floyd Money Mayweather. You know what I mean? Like you know what I mean?
Like he knows he's gonna win.
Huh?
He knows he's gonna win.
Like, man, but you know what it is, man? It's a beautiful thing, and it's not a bad thing. You know, James White. It's not a bad thing to have the spirit of Money Mayweather.
Yeah.
In that, for, you know, for those who know or don't know, you know, Floyd Mayweather, you know, says, "Hey, look, man, like, well, actually, no, I for those people who really know boxing, they're gonna disagree with me because they'll say, yo, Floyd Mayweather ducks fights and sets up fights, but that's a whole other conversation, right? But generally, it's like, okay, well, you know where to find me.
Yeah,
I'll fight anybody, yeah, anytime, anywhere.
Yeah.
I run from no one. So if
50-0, 40-0.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so he's undefeated. But again, just champions the spirit of a boxer or a fighter, MMA fighter, that says, yo, like, you know, my people, you have my number, give me a call. Or like, oh, I keep calling IJ's camp.
Yeah. Yeah.
I keep IJ, man, I'm calling you.
Shout out to Khabib. Number gonna have. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, yeah, man, like, you know, I'm calling your camp. And you guys are ducking me. Yeah. So the audience is just like, wait, so IJ, Darnell's, you know, his camp is calling your camp and you're not responding. So now you got to do a press conference and say, okay, well, do you accept my invitation to fight? Right? And if you say no, well, that's a problem. Because you're like, wait a minute. So wait.
I thought you were the best.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So wait. So
you had the right answer.
What are you doing? What are you doing as an MMA fighter or a fighter? Like, you're not a fighter. You're a lover and you need to go make an R&B album.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's exactly it. We get that sentiment.
Okay.
And so James White champions that sentiment. He's just like, look, man, you guys know where to find me. You guys know what, you know, James White's be like, you guys know where to find me. You guys know what I'm about. You guys know my record. I'm 43-0. Like, he's like, I debate Muslims. I debate Mormons. He's like, yo, Team Woke, like, come at me. You know, I'll set it up. And, you know, James White sends his notes. He sends his notes
ahead of time.
Yeah, he sends his notes. Like, that's what I'm saying. This guy's like, you know, like, yo, his debates are the best. And like, and he's always about giving the audience clarity.
Okay.
So he'll always make sure that
the audience is getting the most out of it. Mm. So they'll say, okay, just for the sake of clarity, I'm going to send you my notes so you know where I'm going. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because that's how confident he is.
Yeah.
In doing that. So it was just one of those things. I said, okay, well, there's a problem here, because if James White, you know, is a debater and he hasn't debated any of these guys, or none of these guys have responded to his call. And in fact, some of them, like Jamar Tisby, Jamar Tisby. So he's part of Team
Woke.
Okay. He's part of The Witness. So he has a podcast, The Witness, him, okay. And Tyler Burns. So, you know, James White has extended an invitation to them, and they've exercised the option to not respond. And not respond, because I guess it's giving him a platform to spew his rhetoric. Mm-hmm. But essentially, they were saying that they would prefer a phone call behind closed doors.
Who, James White?
Tyler Burns. Okay. He would prefer
like a one-on-one.
Yeah, one-to-one, behind closed doors. But
that seems like a wise idea.
Yeah, it's wise. But even as a public figure, and you know, and our beliefs and our convictions are not private. It's a public confession, and you're a public figure. So if you're going to make public statements, you got to address those things in the public. Sure. You know what I mean? So I think that was, I wasn't really a fan of him when he said that. Mm. I like Jamar Tisby. He's part of the reason why I want to be a teacher and why I want to go into the profession. Mm. Okay. But Jamar Tisby was more so like, just don't deal with those guys altogether. Don't go to their conferences. Don't listen to their lectures. Just avoid those guys altogether.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
But again, because part of it is like he was probably assuming that the danger of his teachings would spread further, so he didn't want to give James White a platform.
That's weird. That's strange.
Why you say that?
That's one of those things where I'm like, if a man or a woman, for that matter, has let's say a dangerous idea, I think the way to deal with it is not the way to deal with it is to actually give them a platform, so that if the idea is truly dangerous or stupid, then you can shut it down there and then. But if you don't give it a platform, then you're saying, okay, there's something that they're saying that I'm very scared of, and I don't want people to know because it might be so powerful that it might convince a whole group of people. So the more you do that, it seems you push it underground. The more you push it underground, there's an underbelly that grows. And the next thing you know, it's like a huge movement. The best thing, I'm assuming, what's his name?
Jamar Tisby.
It would be, hey, give him a platform. Let's talk. If James White, if he can't debate and if he's wrong, then everyone can see it, and they'd be like, okay, maybe we have to rethink it. But not giving someone a platform, it'd be like, say I disagreed with you, right? Say I said, you know, say I was not a social conservative. I said, oh man, I don't want to talk to Darnell. He's black and he's a social conservative. I don't want other black people to become social conservatives. So I'm not going to give Darnell a platform on the podcast. That just seems like a terrible idea to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
It seems better to be like, okay, I don't agree with Darnell at all. Let's just say, I know that some people might be convinced by the things that he says, but you know what? I'm going to try my best to try my best to give my side of the presentation so that more people are convinced that mm-hmm. this side is true.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it was just, The Witness, because The Witness used to be the Reformed African American Network. It used to be known as RAN. Okay. RAAN, Reformed African American Network.
Okay.
And so I was down with it. Okay. I was down with the cause because I, you know, I'm Reformed. I'm not American, but African American Network, and it was basically a lane for reformed black men.
Okay,
because there aren't much of us in the camp. It's not a common.
Is that true? It's not very common.
Oh no, it's not. It's rare. It's a rare thing to be a black reform guy.
Why? Do you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I know I'm asking.
It's funny. Yeah. No, it's, you know what? Praise God, because the conversation is going in the right direction. And it's still flowing in line with the first question you asked me, being a black conservative.
Yeah.
So, the conservative perspective in theology is being reformed.
Okay.
That's a reform. That's a reform thing, to be conservative.
Okay.
That's a reform camp. And so, the liberal, oh gosh, oh boy, I'm gonna get myself in trouble. They'll be like, what? You coon? Right? So, this nigga here. That's what you're gonna say. So the liberal side of theology, you know, would be more Pentecostal. Okay. More
that's
charismatic.
That's exactly what I was going to say. More charismatic.
Yeah.
More Pentecostal.
Yeah.
More like free spirited.
Yeah. More free spirited. No manuscript. No manuscript in the pulpit. Yeah. You're like, look, man, God put this on my heart. I wrote something. what the pastor say?
I wrote something. Not actually.
Yeah, but
use
God.
This.
Yeah, but God. But God told me something just now before I came to the pulpit. So, you know, bye bye seminary, right? Right, so then you start preaching by the Spirit. But so that would be the liberal camp, and most blacks come out of that. Now, one of the reasons was the conservative schools were not letting blacks in.
What?
Yeah, so like,
what are we talking about, like,
not now, but in the past.
Yep.
You know, these conservative reform schools were not letting blacks in.
You're talking about like seminaries?
Yeah, seminaries. Okay. Yeah, they were not letting blacks
really?
In. So yeah, so blacks were getting the theology from.
Seems like a stupid idea to do.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just a reflection of the time period that they were in, right? You know, and there were, you know, many reformed guys who owned slaves. Mm-hmm. So for blacks, you know, we're coming up in a more charismatic theological environment.
Yeah,
like most of us did, and so. That would be the more liberal. So when Jamar Tisby and those guys started the RAND network, you know, I was like, okay, yeah, it resonates with me because I was there. And so eventually they changed direction. They rebranded.
Uh-huh. Became the Witness.
And became the Witness and kind of changed their approach.
Okay.
Subtly to really... It became a bit more social justice-y.
Okay.
And so, you know, at that point, you know, and that's why I got to know Jamar Tisby and Tyler Burns through as RAND guys and through the conversation. And so, you know, I still have a respect for them. I still love them. I still enjoy their talks and their approach. So, I'm not going to say that they're not Christians or they're not brothers in the Lord, or I haven't learned from them, or I'm not still learning from them. It was just one of those little nuances. I said, wait, there's something up here that you know, these guys are avoiding the confrontation.
Okay.
In that, so like, not to stereotype black people, so I'll just talk about my experience. You know what I mean? You know, I don't want to do that, but. Like, for example, you know, our culture, like black culture in general, like popular black American culture, hip hop culture, is very confrontational.
Mm-hmm.
We have dance-offs.
Yeah.
Right. Like the movie set, You Got Served.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and you're basically like, oh, okay, we have the best dance crew. Yeah. No, we have the best dance crew. Well, what if the one dance group said, okay, well, we're not showing up because, you know what I mean?
We're too good for you.
Yeah, or you know what I mean? Or, you know, I don't want anybody to see your dance move because it might be, you know, bringing the country down or something. Yeah. You know, so you have, you know, dance-offs. You have...
Rap battles.
You have rap battles, right?
I always wanted to do as a kid.
I can't
even rap though.
Yeah, but, you know, you have different guys doing the thing. But that's very confrontational.
It
doesn't get more confrontational than that. You know, guys do homework.
Some of them are just ruthless.
Yeah, where dudes are doing the homework on you, and they're like, okay, they know your mom has cancer.
Yeah,
they know that, you know, you're illegitimate. Oh, bro, hey, yo, it's one of those things. Yeah, it's very confrontational, even in our sports, basketball, which is, you know, predominantly black
sport. Raptors.
Yeah. Well, yeah, shout out to the Raptors who play game one tonight, you know, praise God. But like, you know, in basketball, there's this thing that we call putting a man on an island, where you'll come down. It's 5-on-5. For those who don't know, basketball's 5-on-5, and you'll come down. And if I have the ball and you're guarding me, mm-hmm. and I'm like, okay, look, man. And, my coach will say, expose this guy. I'm like, all right. I'm waving off my guys. I'm waving off my four.
What?
I'm waving off telling them to go to the side.
So that you can, like...
get you one-on-one where you have no help. So that the other four guys have to follow those other four guys. So now it's just me and you. And then I'm going to do some kind of move to put you on your butt, break your ankle, put you on your butt, dunk on you and humiliate you. And we know this because when you watch those hoop mixtape and all that stuff, and Ball Is Life, you know, when guys get humiliated or embarrassed, what do black people do? They start running across the court. They just, you know, the whole place just goes crazy, right? So it's a very confrontational culture.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting you say that.
What do you mean?
Because I've never thought of it that way. So there's this brown dude down in the States, mm-hmm. basketball player. Mm-hmm. I think he plays street. Mm-hmm. Very skilled. Mm-hmm. He dresses up as Aladdin.
Yeah.
And he goes up to these street ballers like, yeah. oh, hey, I just want to play ball, man. I just want to play ball. And yeah. they're like, hey, get out of here.
Yeah.
He's like, please. And then he'll grab the ball and he does these weird.
Oh, like, yeah. I seen that guy. Yeah.
It's usually with black guys that he's playing with. And then they get so pissed off. They go like sucker punch him.
Yeah.
Oh man, this is crazy.
Yeah. No, it's very confrontational. Even just like, you know, with gang fights and gang wars and things like that. It's a very confrontational culture, which is a beautiful thing. Like, confrontation is a beautiful thing.
Done so, well.
Yeah.
Without killing someone.
Without killing somebody, but it's just part of the nature of the beast where you're just like, look, man, if you open your mouth and you talk reckless. Yeah, I remember talking reckless in school and and someone heard about it.
Yeah.
And they're like, okay, well, I'll see you after school.
Yeah.
Like, we're going, well, I'll just settle this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you just get into a fight and that's it. So it was just weird to me that maybe they didn't grow up like in those cultures. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't want to stereotype these guys or put them anywhere, but it was just like one of those things like, yo, man, everybody knows you don't duck. You don't duck anybody. You know what I mean? Like, I don't duck anybody. Even if I have to take an L, I'm not ducking. Like, I have a podcast and Jamar Tisby might be like, oh,
Darnell, who's this guy?
Darnell, this man, come on, man. You know, and, you know, he's an idiot and he doesn't know what he's talking about. And you know what, Darnell, why, you know what, let's debate.
Yeah.
Let's debate, you know, and I'm like, well, I can't say no.
Yeah.
I can't run. Like, come on. You know, that, my show's over. Like, stop listening to me. Like, unsubscribe. If I'm ducking, like, Interesting. You know what I'm saying? So it's just one of those things like.
Do you think this is built in within North American Africans? African Americans.
Canadians or what?
I'm going to use American.
Yeah, Americans. Yeah, because they're American. Yeah. But what are you saying?
Is this a built-in thing only within the black community in North America? Or is this the case with, would you think?
In
Central Africa or something.
I think it's a part of American culture.
To be confrontational,
to be showing off, to upstage people, to be better than somebody. Huh. So, look, very simple. This is a very good example. Look at the way we play, like, soccer.
Yeah.
Right? You know, how soccer or football is being played. It's played as a team sport.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really individualistically done. But for basketball, we play basketball in North America. It's very individual-based. One-on-one, isolation, put a man on an island, expose him, embarrass him. But when players go to Europe, their basketball functions like soccer.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know
that. Yeah, their system functions like soccer players.
It's like it's very team-oriented.
Team-oriented, pass the ball, cut, playing triangles, teamwork. Yo, that's why I quit playing soccer in the first place. Like, I'm 6 years old, and they're like, pass the ball. I'm like, pass the ball? Like, yo, wait, the scores are like 2-3. I'm like, that's not enough points for me. I'm like, yo, man, I need the spotlight. That's why I started playing basketball. I need the spotlight.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I can't do this team thing. It's just very frustrating. Hockey, I can't, you know, I need to put my man on an island, expose him, and show his mom why she needs to take him out of this league. Like, that's my whole thing. Like, you know what I mean? I'm coming for blood. That's why I enjoy boxing. You know, it's just one of those things like, look, man, I'm going to kill this guy.
There's no hiding.
There's no hiding, man. No hiding.
So it's similar in basketball. There's no hiding.
No. Oh no. Oh no. 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 Oh no. It's one of those.
I'm being educated on basketball right now.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, man. They'll put you. You get put on an island. I've been put on an island. And it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing. Well, guys will put you on an island where they'll just wave you off, and just do something to humiliate you in front of your people.
Right.
You know. So again, but I think it's just, you know, just us being showy people.
Okay.
And individualistic, and it shows up in our sports, shows up in the way we, our music, especially with rap music and, you know, diss tracks. It's just that's the best part of rap is the diss track, you know?
Diss track is when they're dissing another rapper?
Yeah, that's the best part, because you're like, wait a minute, man, you know, keep my name out your mouth, you know, da-da-da-da-da, and you know, and they, you know, who could outdo who, so it's a beautiful thing when you really look at it. So
there's something else that when we're talking about systemic racism, mm-hmm. and you were mentioning that family's institution, right? Family as an institution,
yes.
of some sort. You have this thing that what do you call it? Black love ethic, black ethic love,
black love ethic. Black love ethic, yes.
Black love ethic, mm-hmm. where you talk about how after emancipation, there were black families, there were two-parent black families after mm-hmm. slavery ended then.
Yeah.
After the 1960s.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how we have to recover family. Am I putting words in your mouth?
No.
What can you explain what black love ethic is?
Okay, yes.
In terms of the in regards to like institution and, you know, the general.
Yeah, so just, you know, so like, yeah, I wrote an article on my blog called High End Theories, if you wanted to check it out. The article is called Black Love, White Lies.
That's right. That's what it's called.
Yeah. Black Love, White Lies. And then we were basically talking about, the black love ethic. So it's essentially, there's a right way a black relationship is supposed to look. So a subjective morality seen as an objective morality. It flows out of the unique experience of blacks from the African diaspora. Mm. So the popular narrative is that black love ethic combats the hate black men and black women were taught to have for themselves during slavery. This is what ruined black relationships, but I would argue it has been the departure from marriage and the principles it embodies that has led to the deterioration of the black family in the present day.
Okay. So did this play into when you became a social conservative and you're looking at the family, and you, I believe Tom Sowell talks about this. Mm-hmm. Does he? Did it play into your change in perspective?
What
did? The idea of the idea of family.
No, that's a Christian thing, man. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, man. I got that from the Bible. So like,
shout out to the Bible.
Yeah, shout out to Jesus. You know. Jesus, praise God. Yeah, so basically the family is, well, you know, socially it's the foundation of a culture, mm. of society. Mm. The family is important because, you know, the family produces people, and if you produce good people, as with, you know, two parents home, this is probably the most healthiest situation. Keeps you out of poverty, and it's healthy for a child to have both the mom and dad in the home, so that when the kid goes out in the world, you know, you raise with manners and you go out into the world and be productive. My mom and dad, they weren't the most educated, but they always told me that, you know, manners will get you far. Mm. You know, you go into someone's house, you say good morning, good afternoon, good night. Yeah. You say please and thank you. Mm. And to this day, it's a habit. Like, I can't, like, you know, it's almost like I can't, like I always say please and thank you. I always say please and thank you. You know, good morning, good night, good afternoon.
Yeah.
And that'll take you far in life. Like, yes, like, you know, you can, if you don't have manners and you're smart, that it only gets you so far. But anyways, the idea of the family from the biblical concept is this. The first family is, family starts at marriage. Right? So a man marries a woman and you guys become a family. Hmm. And like, so a man will leave his mother and father and cleave to his wife. So that leaving and cleaving is a change of allegiance.
Okay.
For those of you guys who, so you know, those married couple, you got y'all, or those of you who are about to get married, I'm giving you some marriage counseling in this one right here. So it's a leaving and cleaving. You're changing. It's a change of allegiance.
Okay.
So, you're changing your last name.
Hmm.
So, you know, my wife, Tyra, was a Jackson.
Yeah.
And now she is a Samuels.
Yeah.
So she, her allegiance is no. So people say, oh, well, I want to hyphenate my name. Yes. I want to do this. Well, I want to do this. Well, part of it is Tyra's allegiance. That last name Jackson is her allegiance to her father. Her dropping her father's last name and taking mine is changing her allegiance from her father to me.
Mm.
So now we become our own entity. Mm. I am no longer attached to my parents. They're no longer my family. Tyra's mom and dad are no longer her family. We are a new entity. We are a family. This is why you tell your in-laws, you know, that you can say with pride, yeah, you got to leave my home. You're not allowed over here anymore. People are like, oh, really? That way? Praise God. You know what I mean? So, but it's a change of allegiance. Now, I say all that to say that, okay, so what about a couple who's living together and not married and they have children? Well, they're not a family.
Okay.
So.
What if it's a married couple and a dog?
You're a family.
Okay.
Because it's a change of allegiance. You guys are a family. You want to know how you're family? Because you guys are sharing the same last name, right? So it's under the one title.
Uh-huh.
But for those people who aren't married, you guys are not a family.
Okay.
You guys are friends. You guys are friends. Hence the term boyfriend, girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. But now we've progressed to partners. Right.
Boyfriend, girlfriend.
So, okay. So why would you say that boyfriend, girlfriend, and then they have a kid,
mm-hmm.
right? Live together, let's say 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
They have three kids.
Mm-hmm.
You would say it's not a family.
I'm saying it's not a family in the sense that it isn't like in the essence.
Okay.
Of what is now, of course, yeah, you know, you have the kids. Yeah, you know, everybody's, you know, playing the role. But I'm saying like the essence of what true family is, and when does it actually start? Because you'll have married couples who don't have kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, people look at them, well, you're not a family. You're just a boyfriend and girlfriend who just happen to have a piece of paper. No, that's wrong.
Okay. So what do you mean? What do you mean by marriage then?
So
are you saying you're not a family, or you're a family under a biblical
Covenant.
It's just
covenant. So you've made a covenant.
Does this apply across board?
All
religions.
Yeah, because marriage is for everybody.
Okay.
Not everybody in like homosexuality, but everybody, all cultures.
All cultures.
Because all cultures have been practicing it from the beginning of time.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And God has given that as a gift for us to maintain our love for each other. So again, like all I'm saying is that the essence is, you know, husband and wife. You guys are no longer boyfriend and girlfriend because you guys are sharing the same family name. Usually, you know, the wife takes her husband's name because she's changing her allegiance.
What if a guy takes the girl's name?
Okay, and that's fine too, because the principle is still there. But even then, as a woman, would you really want a man who doesn't take that seriously? But anyways, would you really want a man who's going to give that? I don't know, it's up to you. You know what I mean? If you're the woman who's, you know, you're going to tell your man to, you know, drop his family last name, you know, and at some point, you know, in a marriage, somebody is leading.
Okay.
You know, leading
in what sense?
Both people. So like it's a covenant. So one person calls the other into a covenant. The person who calls a person into a covenant is leading, because you're taking the initiative to say that I'm going to bring you into this relationship and I'm taking responsibility for it.
Okay.
So usually it's the man who gets on his knee and buys the ring.
Mm-hmm.
So he's taken the initiative to say, I'm going to be responsible for maintaining this covenant.
Okay.
Right? So that's where the essence of the family begins, leaving and cleaving, and becoming your own entity as a family. under that one name. And that's why I'm not too much of a fan of hyphenating a name, because again, the hyphenated name is like, well, your allegiance is still to
your whole family.
Your whole family. For the woman, you know, your allegiance is to your dad.
So is
so you, even now the flip the argument for a woman, you know, who's my allegiance to, my mom or my wife? Now the ladies already know the answer to that, because no, you know, nobody wants a mama's boy. You know, no woman wants that. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I'm going to say, oh, well, you know, that's what's ruining some marriages, right? You know, like, oh, you know, my husband listens to his mom too much, and his mom comes in, and, you know, if there's argument, you know, he holds his mom higher. But, you know, right? So the woman sees the argument on the other flip side. She's like, yeah, I hate his mom. You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah. So even at that point, like, showing that allegiance, yes, you do it in name, but you also have to do it in practice. Mm. So, like, even for my wife and my mom, I have to draw that line.
Yeah.
Like it comes there. And I'm sure for you too, is it comes to the line where you're like, okay, look, mom, you need to back off.
Yeah.
You talk to my wife like that again, you will not see her. You will not see the kid anymore.
Yeah.
You know, when you come in my house, you respect her.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing, for the wife and her husband and her dad.
Yeah.
Or her husband and her mom. Again, it's that allegiance. So you become husband and wife, and then when you're not married, mm-hmm. and even though you're living together, and even though you have kids, you're still a boyfriend and girlfriend. You're not husband and wife. You're not a family. So because you guys aren't sharing that name.
Right. So do you think that there's a, what's the word, an undercutting of marriage within Black communities?
No. I wouldn't say there's no undercutting. I'd like to say there's a lot of single parent homes. But I think part of it too is, I mentioned that in my
article. So why is there a lot of single parents?
Well, I think I mentioned this in my Black Love White Lies article. So I was just basically saying that the reason why there's a lot of single parent or single mothers raising kids and no Black men in the home, I think, man, you know, stereotypes are a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Popular Black culture can be a dangerous thing, in that there's an over-sexualization within the Black community and with Black men. Over-sexualization. So like of Black men.
Oh.
So looked at as a sexual object. So you know there's good stereotypes and then there's bad stereotypes. You know, like certain ones work to your favor.
Okay.
And you know, coming back, you know, starting from you know. Slavery and you know Black men being looked at as subhuman.
Okay.
They're more like animals. They are forbidden fruit, you know. And even like, you know, just getting talking sexually, you know, there's a mystique to that, an erotic mystique to that, where it's just like, okay,
big hands.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, like I want a sexual experience that transcends being human. You know what I mean?
Okay.
You know, without, you know, because I know there's kids listening. I know there's kids listening, you know what I mean? So I don't want to be a stumbling block to anybody. We got to put a warning in the intro, like, hey, man, it's a stumble block for you, man. If you struggle with poor men, this is not. Yeah. So, but essentially, you know, there's an over-sexualization of Black men, and some buy into that narrative.
I fully buy into it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, why not?
Oh, you mean
Black men? Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Why not?
Okay.
You know, like, why not buy in? You know what I mean? Like, it's one of those stereotypes, like, oh, you know, women approach you, and they're like, I wonder what it's like, and you're like, oh, that's just a stereotype. Don't stereotype me. Get away from me. You sexy woman. You know what I mean? No one's saying that. No, dudes don't talk like that. They'd be like, oh, shoot. Well, yeah, you know.
You know how it is.
Yeah, you know how. Come on, girl. You know, I mean, come on. You don't got to say all that, you know. Just, okay, what's your number? All right, cool. What time can I call you? All right, cool. All right. You know, and it's just like, it's just lust is an insatiable appetite. And it gets the best of us all, not just Black people, but.
Yeah.
It's dangerous when you're playing with an over-sexualization of a people, and you buy into that.
Yeah.
And, you know, when everybody's buying into it, it leads to a lot of indulgence. You know, it's not hard to make children.
Not very hard.
You know what I mean? It's not, you know, yeah, it's not hard. You know what I mean? It's just, you know, you lie down with somebody and then you wake up and then you're like, oh, frig, like, shoot. So I say all that to say that single parent homes is the reason why you see more single parent homes is because yeah, people aren't marrying before they have sex. You know, men aren't.
Do you think it's that men aren't being responsible?
Yeah, or loving the woman appropriately.
Okay.
And honoring her with the ring, and it goes both ways. Because for women as well, like, you know, because of you know the condom, the invention of the condom and contraceptive, you know, it incentivizes more sex. You know, when there was no contraception, you know, people were careful. People were like, you know, okay, you know, like, you know, mess around, you might get pregnant and then you're in trouble. But now, you know, it kind of gives way. So on the woman's side, you know, the contraception gives way to that as well. So, but part of it essentially is, you know, people aren't getting married, so they're having more casual sex.
Okay.
And because you have casual sex, you have more babies out of wedlock.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I really believe it's just, you know, that stigma that's attached to black men and the over-sexualization and that, you know, you're having more sex, casual sex, and, you know, you're being born out of wedlock. And it's just one of those things, like, you know, I talk with my wife about it all the time. And I'm like, man, like, this is crazy. You know, I'll even go further. Like, I'm not even going to talk about other black people. Forget that. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to talk about them because, you know what? Not all black people are the same.
Yeah.
You know, it's different experience. Yeah. Not all people are the same. But I could talk about my family and I could talk about her family and I could talk about our extended family.
Yeah.
And that's our narrative.
Yeah.
Like that. I don't know about other black people, but I know that's our narrative. Like, there's just a lot of that within our circle, of our families. So again, like, marriage is key and it's foundational, for the family. So because like when a man says I'm going to marry you, like he's saying, okay, well, no, I'm going to be faithful to you. That's it. There's going to be no other person. We're going to work together to build wealth and raise these kids right. But yeah, now you have a bunch of single parent moms raising kids and you know you know we don't gotten into the stats and the harm that it causes when there's no dad in the home, but I want to nuance that this point real quick because in my article I talk about the achievers, the non-achievers and the deviant from Carl Ellis Jr. Who's also a black reform, a theologian and social critic. And his stuff is pretty helpful, I've been finding. So basically, he kind of gave this nuance. He says every racial group has these three categories, right? Of the achievers, non-achievers, and the deviant. Mm-hmm. And so what ends up happening is that... So let me define it. So the achiever... values work as a means of getting ahead, delayed gratification for the sake of a better future. And then the non-achiever devalues work as a means of getting ahead, instant gratification, and disregards the future. And then the third is the deviant who basically rebels against the law because they're just like, okay, look, man, I don't have the skills and just screw the law. I'm going to do my own thing to get ahead. Every group has this. The only difference is with black people, he says, is that our deviant culture is popular culture.
Okay.
And therefore, we are defined by our minority. So he says, like, every group has an achiever. Because, you know, being achievers is survival.
Yeah.
So we have, every racial group has their surviving group. And the ones that do well and the ones that pass down wealth and get it.
Yeah.
So black people have a lot of achievers, but you wouldn't know that if you watch TV.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't know that if you follow Six Buzz on Instagram.
What's that?
Oh, yeah, don't
follow it.
No. People be like, all right, let me take a look what they're talking about. Okay. But yeah, like Six Buzz, you know, like Six Buzz is this Instagram page, and they post a lot of urban stuff within Toronto from Toronto.
Okay,
and so some of the stuff is like some ratchet stuff and foolishness. But you know, if you follow that, you know what I mean. So you're not going to see a lot of black achiever content in it.
Interesting. Okay,
you're going to see a lot of deviant underachiever balance, more so more underachiever. So, for example, an underachiever value, holding money up to your ear, having a stack of money.
Like a phone?
Yeah, like a phone. Holding money up to your ear to show how much money you got.
Okay.
That's not necessarily deviant, but yeah, it's underachiever. Okay. Because that money should be invested in something.
Okay, then. This is some investment advice here.
Yeah, right. You know what I mean? So
get some mutual funds.
Yeah, yeah. You see what I'm saying? So yeah, like, wait, achievers don't hold money up to their ear. Right. Achievers aren't concerned with what the latest shoe is.
Delayed gratification.
Yeah. An achiever, woman or male, doesn't lay down with somebody until they get married, because one, you know, they, family's important. And two, that you don't want to be having kids out of wedlock. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I say all that to say that, you know, with the single parent homes, I'm sure that it's not a majority thing among Black people that there are achievers. But again, you know, there are people who underachieve, and just don't know any better. They're not deviant. Underachievers are not deviant. So for example, not all achievers are rich.
Yeah.
So you have unachievers. You have achievers in the hood. Mm. You have achievers in government housing. But guess what? The achievers don't stay there. Mm. Right? Because they're achievers.
They may start there.
Yeah, they may start there, or, you know, tough times. Yeah. You know, just bad luck. God's providence, you know, just took you there. You know, and you're in the hood. And, you know, I remember growing up in government housing. Mm. And you know, my neighbor, you know, we all had like a plot of grass. Yeah, I grew up in McCarty Court, and everybody had a plot of grass. Yeah. And so, like, one of my neighbors was like, he used to yell at us for walking on his grass. Uh-huh. I'm like, what do you mean for walking on your grass? Come on, man. Like, this is McCarty Court. Who gives a rip? I don't care about freaking grass.
Yeah.
But what he cared about the little property that he did have, yeah, like ownership. Mm. Like, ownership was valuable to him. And guess what? He wasn't there very long. You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't there very long. And some people end up living there, and you know, they don't take care of their place, and so forth. So, you know, like, underachiever values, you know, you don't progress. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't make you necessarily a bad person. It's just like, you just don't know.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't want to stereotype Black people to say that we're all not, you know, taking care of our kids. There's just some who are underachievers. And like I said, it's popular culture. You know, our deviant underachiever culture is popular culture.
Mm. So the solution would be to try to undercut that.
I don't think you can undercut it. I don't think so? No, because popular culture is... But
can you make it unpopular?
No. No, you know why? Because it's sin. And sin sells. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, you know, we're Christians. We, you know, come on, man. You're not going to get rid of the enticement of sin.
But you could. Could you not start emphasizing overachievers? The attitude that overachievers have as a thing to strive towards?
No.
No?
No. Good thing I'm on the show. No. No, man. It's not, you know, being an achiever is... like, you know, when I got the talk from my mom and dad, and they're like, hey, man, you know, like, you know, you're a Black kid, you know, the system is against you. Yeah. That didn't motivate me to be an achiever. I was like, man, I'm not trying to work twice as hard. You know what I mean? Like, to be a doctor.
Yeah.
To be a lawyer. For what? You know, I'm watching TV and, you know, Allen Iverson is in the NBA, all tatted up, chains. The ladies love him. He's 6 foot. He's actually probably like 5'11", weighs 160 pounds. He's like me. He's like a regular human being who's doing what he loves to do, and doing it at a high level.
Yeah.
Or I could be a rapper. You know what I mean? Just rap a whole bunch of stuff and, you know, carry on and say whatever I want and go far further. Like all those things are a lot more entertaining and more appetizing to a young mind. It's easier, you know, being a comedian, you know, getting on. I wanted to be a comedian, you know. I wanted to be on. Yeah, when I was a kid, man, I used to study it a bit. I was really thinking about doing that, you know, but then I became a Christian and, you know, I couldn't be swearing like that. So I got a potty mouth by nature. So I really wanted to be on stage, like saying, mother F this, oh, this motherfucker, see these motherfuckers, oh, motherfucker, oh, man, I hate them motherfuckers, oh, motherfucker, oh, they, I love them motherfuckers. So that was, you know, that's how I used to talk. But I used to, you know, I wanted to be that comedian, like, oh, man, F these ninjas, oh, I hate motherfuckers, these motherfuckers, man, step on my motherfucking shoes. That's what I wanted to do, right? Like, so, like, you can see me as a kid, like me telling me about systemic racism as a kid did not motivate me to want to go and work hard.
Okay,
you know what I mean? I'm like, no, man, I want to be on stage telling jokes like Martin Lawrence. I want to be on Def Comedy Jam. Yeah. I want to be in the NBA. I want to be like Will Smith. Yeah, look, I'm bringing up Will again. Like, you know, Will was a slacker, right? Yeah, chasing girls. Yeah, Will was a slacker. Carlton was the hard worker, right?
Oh, you mean from
Fresh Prince.
Okay, I thought you were talking about real life.
Yeah. So Will was a slacker in Fresh Prince, and Carlton was a hard worker. But then when it's time to go to college, they ended up in the same place. Mm-hmm. So how is Carlton getting straight A's and Will not, and they're ending up in the same place? Right. So for me, so I'm like, yeah, like, you know, my mom's telling me, you got to work twice as hard to get ahead. I'm like, twice as hard, man, after that. Like, man, I'm trying to play basketball or rap or something, man. That's just too much work. Like, come on, man. That's like, you know, kids aren't stupid. Young people aren't stupid. Black people are not stupid.
Yeah.
You keep telling them, like, yo, man, the world is against you. So what? So what, you're gonna beat the world? You, that one person? Mm. Come on, man. Like, you know, look, Obama was president. 2 terms. What? Nothing changed. Mm. People don't change. Come on, man. Like, you know, he comes and goes. He's history now.
Yeah.
He's in the past. He's gone now. And now, you know, people look to other things. Just comes and goes. So I don't think that narrative can change.
Okay.
The only way I see it changing is through Christ. And Jesus Christ is the paradigm. Jesus is truth. So he's walking, talking, incarnate truth. Mm. Breathing truth. So based on the scriptures, define your reality. Not TV. Mm. Not culture. Culture does not define your reality. Not even your skin color, the way people treat you. That does not define your reality. The scriptures do. Mm. And that's the only way you can break free from that bondage of popular culture.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm. You don't think there's any other way?
Well,
if you take personal response,
yeah. Well, okay. You know what? Okay. Well, you know, I'll be gracious and say there's another way. Being pro-black. You know, being pro-black in that, you really have to champion being black as the end in itself. That has to be the paradigm that you have to work from. So you say something like this. I want to, because of, you know, the social ills that's going on with black people, I want to be the change. I want to be that black man. Mm. I want to be a good black man. I want to see black people do better. I want black people to be kings. I want black people are kings. Black people are queens. You're a queen. You're a king. You know, black is beautiful.
Yeah.
Light skin is sort of not. But dark and being black is beautiful. And being black and that's the end goal. And that's fine. But, you know, what does it profit a man to gain the world and lose his soul? Mm. Like, you know, it's a motivation for some, but not a motivation for all. It's funny because my wife was on that tip. When she was in college.
Okay.
So when she was part of the Black Student Union.
Yeah.
And she was more militant in her thinking.
And then she...
Huh?
Did you say your wife was black militant?
Yeah, but was more militant, yes.
In college?
Yeah. Yeah, so she was on that tip. Real social justice-y before social justice was cool.
Wow.
Yeah, so my wife was on that tip and, you know, and wanting to see black people as seen as respectable.
Yeah.
That was her thing. Like, you know, wanting to see black people conduct themselves with dignity and pride and be successful. And that was the motivation that spurred her to want to do good works and give back. Mm. Yeah. So that's where she was at. And I'm saying, like, you can still help out a community. You can still help the Black community without championing, I guess, a Black love ethic, I guess.
Okay.
You can still do that apart from that. Like I'm not, I don't have nothing to prove. I don't, for me, like, and that's fine. You know, for people who want to champion that Black love ethic, you know, you're free to do that.
Mm.
But again, like, it still falls short. It's still not an end in of itself. You know, like saying things like, you know, Adam, you know, the first human being was Black. You know, all people descend. Oh, I'm gonna say something very, oh boy. Okay, I just gotta say it. All people don't come from Africa. So the narrative is that all Black people come from Africa. Not just Black people, but everybody.
Yeah, human.
Asians, white, yeah, you know, all people descend from Africa.
I would believe that. Huh? That's what I would think.
Yeah, you would think that.
Yeah.
Why?
What are you going to say?
No. You say your piece, man. This is your show, man. say your piece. So we can just see where I'm going. So yeah, okay. you say your piece.
Well, I would say that. I mean, that's what the experts in the field have said, that we all migrated from Central or North or Central Africa and moved upwards towards Eurasia. Some went towards Mongolia, China now, and then others went to the west side, and then the continent kind of split apart, and then skin color changed because of the environment. That's what I would think. So.
Yeah. No. I've heard that, but again, you know, people come. Well, the first person came from the Garden of Eden, right? Right. The first person, the first human being, comes from the Garden of Eden.
Why can't it be in Africa?
Because the Garden of Eden is no longer accessible. Africa is.
Okay.
So we start there.
Okay.
So, like, so my thing is this, and again, like, you know, I'm just deducing.
Yeah.
I'm just deducing. So, the first human being, if the first person comes from Africa and the first person on the continent of Africa,
yeah.
How did they get there?
How did they get there?
You're right, right? So in that we know what, like, according to the biblical narrative, that, you know, man was in the Garden of Eden kicking it with God until God kicked them out. Okay. And then they landed on wherever they landed. But if you're deducing the argument far back, we have to go back to the garden. Right, and from that point on, you know, there wasn't any evidence to say what Adam and Eve look like.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with it, but is that only the case if you take the creation account literally?
What is this guy talking about? What do you mean? Well, of course we have to take it literally. Well, how else are you going to take it? What? But this is a fable? Like Jesus refers to Adam as a real person.
No, I'm not saying Adam's not a real person. That's not what I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm saying the creation account of that God created Adam and Eve from instantaneously. I guess that's the word I'm looking for.
Like from, well, made from the dust?
Yeah, just like created them instantaneously. Uh-huh. You know, the 6-7 days of creation, six days of creation. Uh-huh. That's exactly the way exactly how it functioned.
Mm-hmm.
Is that only the case if you take, I mean, I'm not saying you take the 6-day account literally, mm-hmm. but I'm saying, do you only have a problem with people coming out of Africa if you take the creation account literally and say, okay, God created Adam and Eve instantly and then they came from the dirt, boom.
Mm-hmm. And that, yeah, they were in the garden,
yeah,
with God. And then again, like all I'm saying is that, you know, if you're going to deduce the argument to the first man and where he first came from, man first comes from the garden.
Okay.
And the garden is a real place that we're still trying to get back to.
Okay.
That's all I'm saying. So yeah, so what I'm saying is, like, maybe I'm speaking out of shock value, but you can say, like, okay, you know, the first man came from Africa and all men came from Africa, but the first man starts in the garden.
Okay.
You got to go back to
so
the garden.
Okay.
So the garden's no longer accessible until new heavens, new earth.
So it's some sort of, it's not on earth. The garden wouldn't be on earth. It would be like somewhere else.
Well, the garden was on earth and that realm is closed.
Okay.
So new heavens, new earth comes down to us. So we're still going to be dwelling here, but it's just going to be a renewed creation. Because right now we're in a fallen creation.
Okay.
And it'll be renewed. Right? It's progression, right? We started out in a garden and then we're going to end off in a city. Right? Still fulfilling the cultural mandate to cultivate creation, to make it into something. You know, glorify God and use for human advancement.
Mm.
So heaven is still a place where we dwell here on earth.
Okay.
And we continue living our lives like we usually do, but to the glory of God, in a more advanced society than from the garden.
Okay.
But I only say that like just, you know, working from a presupposition of, you know, if we're going to deduce, you know, first man, well, first man comes from the garden.
Hmm.
And so we look at that narrative and we work from that. So again, like, you know, if you want to champion, you know, being black as the paradigm which interprets your whole reality, it interprets your economics, it interprets your sociology, it interprets your politics, it interprets your theology, then, I mean, yeah, you know, that's you,
yeah.
You know. But again, it falls short. It still falls short of reality,
mm-hmm.
You know, a biblical reality and the ultimate reality. But again, if you, again, look back to the point, you know, you're trying to dodge this deviant popular black culture thing. So some people will champion the black ethic to escape that.
Okay.
I think from the Christian narrative, I think you can still escape that without necessarily championing a black paradigm of truth, like almost like a deity type thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Man, right. Thank you, sir. We've been doing this for like, I guess, almost 2 hours.
Almost. Oh, shoot. Yeah, I know.
So.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, thanks so much for doing this.
Right. Yeah, yeah, man. No, thank you for having me on the show, man. It was a lot of fun.
Man, there's a lot more that I want to talk about, so next time.
Oh, next time. Next time. Okay. Whoa, really? Next time. Oh, wow. Okay, this is cool. I hope, look, man, I hope this is helpful for people.
I think it is,
and I hope it was deep enough, because you know you've been having like professors on the show, man,
bro,
and I'm, you know, these big time guys, and I'm just a poor black man trying to make it out of Brampton.
No, you're definitely not, man. That's awesome though. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot, IJ.